Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, November 18th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book is a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any experience of a negative emotional state into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. It's an internal guidance system. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click on the link, download it, print it off, and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows like this one, including yesterday's show where I stepped through a worksheet process of my own. And those shows contain episodes like that where people have actually been stepped through the worksheet process, and shows where people have given powerful testimonials about how the application of that worksheet process has been a positive benefit in their lives. If you have a comment or a question, if you want some help working through a worksheet, if you've got a suggestion for a topic for a show or someone for us to interview, give us a call, 563-999-3581. And once you call that number, if you want to talk, press the number 1. It'll put a question mark by your phone number, and I'll announce you by your area code. We're also doing this year the Course in Miracles workbook lessons. This is the 322nd day of the year. Today's lesson simply reads, I can give up only that which was never real. The commentary reads, I sacrifice illusions, nothing more. Nothing real can be destroyed. Nothing unreal exists. That's right near the beginning of the Course in Miracles in the intro. So here we're being reminded of that again in this lesson, 322 days in. And as illusions go, I find the gifts illusions tried to hide. right? As I get the illusions out of the way, I see the true gifts of life and creation awaiting me in shining welcome, in the readiness to give the Creator's ancient messages to me. The Creator's memory abides in every gift that I receive, and every dream serves only to conceal my higher self, my true self, which is the Creator's only offspring, the likeness of the Creator, the Holy One, the one mind who still abides in that Creator forever, as the Creator still abides in each and every one of us. So, Father, to you all sacrifice remains forever inconceivable. Nothing can be lost or gained. It is all here all the time. And so I cannot sacrifice except my dreams. As you created me, I can give up nothing you gave me. What you did not give to me has no reality. What loss can I anticipate except the loss of fear and the return of love into my mind? So the Pam Grout's Course in Miracles experiment, lesson number 327, is titled, Hit the Road, Smack, No More, No More. She quotes Jody Picoult as saying, words are like eggs dropped from great heights. You can no more call them back than ignore the mess they leave when they fall. Pam writes, when I talk smack about my life, even little things like, quote, oh, I wish I'd gotten up earlier, close quotes, or quote, I wish that idiot in the passenger lane hadn't cut me off, close quote. Whenever I do that, I create a resonant field of issues and problems. Instead of playing beautiful symphonies with my words, instead of utilizing them to create dreams, I often waste them moaning about problems. Lesson 322 says, forget about it. Those problems are just the ego talking, and the ego is not real. Grievances hide all of the gifts that await me in shining welcome, as this lesson calls it. Beyond the illusions is the dude's overriding message. Quote, sacrifice remains forever inconceivable. Close quotes. The only thing I could ever lose is my fear. So, I anticipate the loss of fear and the return of love into my mind. That's today's Course in Miracles workbook and the Course in Miracles experiment commentary. And as usual, we've got about 50 minutes left to entertain your comments or questions, suggestions. I should remind people that today's a Thursday, so there will be a support group available through Zoom tonight from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. All the information you need for joining that group is available on the MindShiftersAcademy.org website. And please remember there's a separate login info page for the Tuesday and the Thursday group. So, we have time for your comments and your questions. What was your response to yesterday's session and the worksheet that I did online? What is your comment or question about your own issue and how to apply a worksheet to that issue? I don't see our brand new caller from yesterday who had a 248 area code, and he was calling because he wanted somebody to talk to because he was depressed and upset. And he found us on Blog Talk Radio. So here's hoping that's one more person who's been introduced to the worksheet process and will take advantage of it and start turning those negative emotional states that he was experiencing into part of his own guidance system. I think I mentioned that on Tuesday we had a support group. I'll hold that because we have somebody from area code 904 calling in. All right, you're in the air, 904. Give us a name, and how can we support you?
Well, aloha. My name is Dusty. I'm in
Dusty?
Yes. And I'm an old friend of Michael's, actually, from way back. And
Dusty, I can barely hear you, and my volume is all the way up. Can you speak up, please? Dusty, are you there? And now I hear nothing. And now I hear rustling. Dusty, are you there? It's even less. There's a faint echo of a voice off in the distance. However, the rustling is very clear, so there's something touching your microphone.
I will call right back.
Now, there I can hear you. All right, we'll wait for Dusty. I'm turning my volume back down to the normal level. And I don't know where Dusty's located, but he said aloha. Maybe he's one of our listeners from Hawaii. And the person that called in yesterday that had the same kind of area code as Michelle, who does work for us, running the switchboard from time to time, was from Detroit. Here's another attempt with Dusty. Are you there? The call dropped again. So our call-in number is 563-999-3581. Dusty, are you there?
I am trying very much. My phone just blitzed out, and I'm trying, but it's not going into the right mode. And I apologize for taking your time. I'll try it again when I got this worked out. Thank you.
All right, blessings. So I just got a text message from someone, as you might have heard, because my phone wasn't on silent. And this person is asking for a clarification for the difference between using affirmations and changing neural pathways. So that's a powerful question. I think there are many ways to answer that. The biggest difference or the biggest dynamic that changes something rather than just using positive affirmations is to be aware that as I use affirmations, I'm using words. I'm using my conscious logical mind. And as Michael Rice points out, eventually there is a connection, there is a dynamic that Michael calls the regulatory speech center of the brain, and it is possible to work with my words, watch my words, and change them and start to change the programming in my brain. And that is a possibility. It's also really important to understand that I can talk and talk and talk and talk and not change a thing about my neural pathways if in my unconscious mind or in the part of my mind that I'm not willing to look at directly, I'm hiding from myself negative conclusions, traumatic energies, etc. So what the people who do the research on trauma talk about is having a visceral experience, having the energy of the emotions activated and up in my system while I make a corrective shift. So Bessel van der Kolk is one of the premier researchers for trauma, healing trauma. I think he's got a trauma center that he's run for over 30 years. And I was just about to talk about how on Tuesday night in our group we had three people who each had significant abusive childhoods, and we listened to one of the chapters from Bessel van der Kolk's book, and the book is titled The Body Keeps the Score. And one of the things that's pointed out in that book is that as we go through events in our lives and we download disruptive energies, which become the residual effects of a past trauma, as that happens, each of us is creating different neural pathways, different defense mechanisms in our system, different needs, therefore, for healing. Right? There's no such thing as one size fits all healing for trauma. That's one of the first things he talks about in the preface of that book. That there's a lot of good stuff in that book about healing trauma and about the chapter particularly that we were listening to on Tuesday was about how when traumatic energy is stored in the body, it disrupts your experience of your body. So there are people who literally lose their ability to know what they're feeling physically and emotionally. And they lose it because it was part of an adaptation that their body created in order to survive a trauma or to cope with the negative effects of something they experienced as being traumatic. So when my neural pathways get set or adjusted to cope with a traumatic energy, then every time anything related to that energy, any thought, any image, any physical sensation, any emotion gets triggered in my mind, the adaptation that I created to cope with the pain of the trauma or the disruption of the trauma kicks in and replays. So the difference between just saying a positive affirmation and rewiring my neural pathways is I may need to put my body in a posture or a position that is antithetical to or the same as what happened when I was traumatized. So, for instance, I did an interview with Dr. Pat Ogden from the Sensory Motor Institute out in Colorado, and she's pioneered work in watching people's physical movements, eye movements, hand movements, breath, etc., as they speak, especially if they're talking about something traumatic. And when she notices a change in their motor movements or their facial expression, then she will highlight that for them and ask them to either go back and do that move again or to move in an opposite way. And when that happens, all kinds of things shift in the person's body, in their perspective, in their experience. Here's another example. I had a woman come to see me earlier this year, and she had been attacked by a dog quite viciously and required surgery and stitches. And fortunately, it was one of those, two-session miracle cure type things. And this can happen when you're well-trained in different trauma types, trauma resolution techniques, and the trauma you're working on is not prolonged childhood trauma or, 17 combat missions, et cetera. This is just this one specific event. And so the woman came in and we did a little bit of the EMDR, which is stands for eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. And I combined that with the technique that's called brain spotting, which basically just notices what eye movement position is associated with the most physical and emotional upset. So I combined those two, and the woman said, "Wow, that's amazing. I think about that trauma right now." This is after maybe, 20 minutes into our second session. And she felt like she was fixed, cured, miracle. And I said, "Okay, now remember how you said that when the dog jumped up and bit your arm and tried to pull you off the chair, that you were terrified that if it got you on the ground, it would go for your neck and kill you. It's one of those breeds that's known to be quite vicious at times." And she said, "Yes." And I said, "And when you talked about that, you leaned off to your left and dragged your arm low." So I said, "Why don't you just get in that position, shift like your arm is hanging off the chair and you're being pulled down to the left." And she did and immediately flooded with tears and emotions and shaking. And then we went through the brain spotting and the EMDR procedure until that was relieved. Well, the point here is, the question is, what's the difference between a positive affirmation and changing neural pathways? Well, I could have told her, "That's great." When she said, "I think about that dog biting me and I don't have any more problems anymore." And when she was sitting upright in her chair, comfortable in my office, she was being honest. She could think about the image of the dog grabbing her and biting her, and she didn't have any upset. But it didn't change the neural pathways in her that were related to the position she was in when she had the terror and the terrifying thought that if this dog gets me on the ground, it's going to go for my neck and kill me. So when she moved into that position, holding all of these other aspects of the trauma, all of a sudden the neural pathways associated with that trauma and the belief that she's going to die flooded into her experience. Once it was up, now when we do the breathing and the self-calming and the eye movements and the alternating bilateral stimulation and the brain spotting technique, she released that energy, and that's a kind of a primary example of the difference between just talking about, "I feel so much better and thank you, and that visualization was nice, and now I'm visualizing myself being safe around that dog," and that's an affirmation type approach, as opposed to actually accessing the thoughts, the images, the physical sensations, the body postures, and the energy of, "Oh my God, I'm going to die," or whatever the traumatic response was, and letting it get activated in the human being in the moment, and then applying the corrective. And then the brain does its work to make sense of the fact that I have this felt sense, I have this visceral knowing I'm going to die. And I downloaded it when that dog almost pulled me off the chair and was ripping my arm apart so much that I needed surgery to put my arm back together. But when I'm sitting here in the therapist's office or when I'm driving my car and with my friends, I feel safe. I know I'm safe. I have that knowing. But the other knowing that I'm going to die and this dog's going to rip my throat out is buried in my mindset. It's buried in my consciousness. And until I can access it in the context of the safety of a therapeutic environment and with practice of the proper tools to help it be resolved, my mind hides from me the physical knowing that I'm going to die. I'm not safe. And so I can have, you know, an infinite number of worldviews. Some of them say I'm a lousy person. Some of them say I'm a very effective therapist. Some of them say I'm a pretty good dad. Some of them say I'm a lousy parent. I can have all of those worldviews in my consciousness and not be aware of them, because I'll only be looking at one worldview at a time. And within each worldview that comes into my mind at a conscious level, my mind will be actively working to make sense of that worldview. So if I get triggered to the trauma of the dog that was, you know, ripping my arm apart and dragging me to the ground, if I get triggered to that experience, I can be in a car with loving friends, laughing one minute, having, you know, this perfectly wonderful time, and the next minute, my mind will show me, Tim, you're in danger of dying right now, and I'll have a panic attack. And nobody around me will be able to make any sense of it because they don't have access to that worldview in me that contains the implicit, emotionally based, deep felt knowing that I'm going to die. And just as quickly as it came, if I make a shift, I use a tool, we drive past the place that had the picture of the dogs that was, you know, the dogs in the picture were playing, but they were jumping up, and that triggered my thought of the dog that jumped up and grabbed my arm. Whatever that is, as I move past it and I shift my focus, a different worldview comes into my direct view and experience. And within that worldview, I can, everything I see helps me understand that I'm safe. And the world is a safe place, and I'm surrounded by friends. So, you know, I can talk about how I'm safe until I'm completely out of breath and ready for bed at night, but it won't change if I'm holding within my consciousness, within my mindset, that part of me that I'm not looking at in this moment, we call it the unconscious, if I'm holding in that realm deep visceral knowings of trauma, and I'm not safe, and I may die, etc. And there's no amount of simply repeating affirmations that will access and resolve my unconscious, deeply held, viscerally awake and alive, implicit emotional knowings. So, that's the answer to a question, and that will be in the archives for the person that sent that in. And we've got about 30 minutes left if we need them. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. I see the 904 area code number back up. If you want to try again, just press 1 on your phone. And we'll try to address your comments or questions, Dusty. 563-999-3581. Dusty, are you there?
I am, but my phone is malfunctioning. I apologize for that.
Well, we can hear you now if you're ready to talk.
Oh, you can. Oh, good. I'm yelling into my microphone with all kinds of displays that aren't supposed to be there in front of me. But I'm glad you can hear me. Thank you for your program. I just picked up some tips. Thank you for that. I have a question. Can you hear me?
What would that question be?
Earlier, you talked about having little, I don't know, I'm going to use my own words here, I guess, mind loops, you know, where you're dwelling on something insignificant, little nyan-nyan-nyan-nyans like that. I try to stay in present time, but I live alone, so now and then, quite often, actually, I find myself in some kind of meaningless loop that does no good for me or anybody, and I wonder if you have any tips, maybe on how to deal with that, other than, you know, to be aware and breathe, that sort of thing.
Well, so if Michael Rice were here and when he was at an intensive, he would turn to his whiteboard and point to the top of it where it would say all of the above. So all of the tools Michael has might be used in various ways to help stop a negative recurring thought that's, you know, playing in a loop. One of the ways that yields a lot of benefit for Michael and other people who use the tools is to identify the goal that could be derived from that negative talk and put it on a worksheet. Another way is to just focus on the breath and watch the negative thought loops with gentle, childlike curiosity. And so instead of fighting against it, just chuckling at, wow, look at that. I'm really beating myself up heavy today. I seem to be stuck in this negative thought loop. You know, you're a lousy therapist, you're a bad husband, you're, you know, only barely adequate as a parent, whatever my negative thought loop is, and just kind of laugh about it, chuckle at it. Another one is the very, very similar to Michael's work is Byron Katie's work. And Byron Katie's work can be summarized by the awareness that she had that she only suffers when she believes her negative thoughts. So she can have all the negative thoughts, you know, that any that want to come floating through her mind, and she lets them be there and she lets them float through, and if they seem to have some edge to them or they seem to keep recurring, then she'll pull out her worksheet, which is, you know, in some ways very, very similar to Michael's, and it's just having her question, what's the truth of this thought? Is it true is the first question. Often the first answer is yes, it's true. The second question is, can I absolutely, without any doubt, know that it's true? And the truly honest person usually then says, well, no, I can't absolutely, beyond any shadow of a doubt, know that this is true. But even if the answer is yes, then you move on to the next question, which is, how do I feel when I believe this is true? And I answer that question deeply. I let myself really get in touch with the visceral physical sensations, the emotions, etc. And then the fourth question is, what would my life be like if I no longer believed this thought? And then beyond that, on her worksheet, she's got several turnarounds. So let's say my thought is, you know, this person betrayed me, and And that's got me all upset because I feel like I've been betrayed or abandoned by someone. So the turnaround would be, this person didn't abandon me. This person is always there for me. Or this person did what they did for my benefit. Or another turnaround might be, I abandoned this person. And just playing with those questions and turnarounds and being willing to sit with them and embody them usually dismantles the negative impact of the negative thoughts. So there's a couple ideas for you.
Well, those are wonderful. I bet you can hear me now better, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. I finally, anyways, yes. I mean, those are some great things. And the one that leapt out for me that really resonated was the one on chuckling. I love that one. And I'm going to carry that through with me. And I don't call in even a Michael show very often, but I do find that, by the way, and I guess I'm saying this as much as anybody listening that might be on the fence about calling, is that by having a short dialogue and letting myself say and be heard, I don't know, sometimes it helps me go forward for some reason. It kind of helps coagulate or congeal that whole way of being, just by the fact that we're talking, or, you know, there's this dialogue. And I appreciate the clear way you have of putting things. I wanted to share one real short little, I don't know whether you call it a blessing or what you call it, really, but it's about the chuckling thing. And it says, blessed are we who can laugh at ourselves, for we shall always be amused. And, boy, that's always true. And so chuckling and keeping that kind of humor going, that works for me. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome and deserving. Is there anything else we can do to support you today?
You know, I've enjoyed what I have heard today a lot, and it has spoke to me, and I think I would just rather listen to you. Thank you.
All right. Blessings. Thanks for the call. So we have about 21 minutes left, 20 minutes left. We don't really need to use them all because today Michael and Jeannie's hour is going to be a replay of Empowered to Heal Part 1. They've had something come up in their day today, short notice, and so they will be unavailable, and we'll play the best of show Empowered to Heal Part 1. And if my guess is correct, this is the audio of Michael's two-hour workshop titled Empowered to Heal. And it is the first hour of that two-hour workshop. When I did that workshop in my Tuesday support group for years, that was one of my favorite videos. We would watch each of those videos at least twice a year. And I was always glad when that came up. And there were times when I would choose to play that for new people, actually break the rotation and listen to it again, because it's so useful to help us begin to think about how everything is energy and everything we choose to do with our words, with our thoughts, is a creative process. And so if we allow these negative thoughts to flow and fight against them and believe them and get bitter about them, then basically we're adding energy and a negative energy to our experience, to the field of life around us. On the other hand, if I recognize, hey, everything's energy and this stuff, you know, as thoughts can just flow through me and I don't have control over that, but I do have control over whether or not I get upset over it. I do have control over whether or not I pour a lot of negative mind energy into the thought. Or, as we were talking about with Dusty, if I just take a fundamentally entertained and entertaining approach to this thing we call life, the process of life flowing into, in, through, as, and around me. And I just watch it and say, wow, that's interesting. Michael Singer would call us to just watch when you have an intense heartache or upset. Just watch it with curiosity and say, wow, I had no idea that my heart was capable of creating such intense physical and emotional sensations. And if I do that rather than judge it as bad and fight against it, I create a very different experience of life in that moment. So, more on that in Michael's Empowered to Heal, Part 1, coming up. And again, tonight, 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time, there will be a Mind Shifter support group in on Zoom. I'll be sitting here in Crystal Lake, Illinois, but you can be wherever you want on the globe as long as you've got internet access. And you can join us, or you can do somebody else a favor and pass the information along to them, and they can join us. It's absolutely free. And all of the information for how to join us in that support group on Zoom tonight from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central is available at the mindshiftersacademy.org website. In the meantime, we have 17 minutes left, maybe 15. 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. I've had several people recently ask me about books and about book titles for one topic or another. And I'll mention, because that's happened again today, somebody asked me for the titles of a book that might work for boundaries. And if you go to mindshiftersacademy.org, there's a page of book titles, books that we've discussed on the Mind Shifters Radio. These days we're calling it a podcast. And those books include things like The Empath Survival Guide by Judith Orloff, the book by Peter Levine titled In an Unspoken Voice, How the Body Releases Trauma and Restores Goodness, Welcoming the Unwelcome by Pema Chodron, Healing Depression by Jody Skillicorn Without Medication, Necessary Endings by Dr. Henry Cloud. The reason that came up is because someone texted me today and asked for a book title on boundaries. And so I ended up sending the one that's by Cloud and Townsend, Dr. Henry Cloud and I think it's Peter Townsend, although that might be my mind playing tricks with me because of the Who. And so that book is written by two people who identify as Christian authors. There's also Anne Catherine, and she's written two books on boundaries. One of them is Where to Draw the Line, How to Set Healthy Boundaries Every Day. And there's another one that she's written. So if you know somebody who's struggling with boundaries or wants to know how to define boundaries or how to use boundaries more, I'll call it effectively in their lives. Those are two books. And I recommend that you go through the MindShiftersAcademy.org website and scroll through the list of books we've discussed, things like Proof of Heaven by Evan Alexander, Suggestible You by Eric Vance, The Verbally Abusive Relationship, How to Recognize and Respond by Patricia Evans, A Course in Miracles Made Easy by Alan Cohen, which is a book that I probably read at least once a year, if not twice a year. It Didn't Start With You by Mark Wolin. Two books by Michael Singer, The Untethered Soul and The Surrender Experiment, Relationship Magic by Guy Finley. The Courage to Be Free by Guy Finley. Several books by Anthony DeMello, Awareness and Taking Flight. The book by Matt Kahn titled Whatever Arises, Love That. Everything is Here to Help You by Matt Kahn. Sherry Huber wrote a book titled There Is Nothing Wrong With You, Going Beyond Self-Hate, A Compassionate Process for Learning to Accept Yourself Exactly as You Are. James and Steph Pupura wrote a book, Perception, Seeing is Not Believing. So, wonderful resources available in the archives at whyagain.org. A few years ago now, almost a few years ago now, I expanded our efforts to get exposure for this work, and I created the MindShiftersAcademy.org website. And put some files up there for audio files. It's a little bit easier to find some of those. And so that's another good resource. And so if no one has a comment or a question, we've only got about 12 minutes left in this hour. I'll go ahead and start the second hour, which is going to be an hour of the lecture, Empowered to Heal, Part 1. Dr. Michael Rice giving one of my favorite out of the 15 or 16 or 17 different DVDs that are available. And you can purchase those DVDs and listen to them on your own at whyagain.org and or you can start your own support group, which is how this MindShifters Radio began, as a mechanism to support people who were going to be starting their own support groups after Michael and Jeannie had been through town sharing the process of all of the various tools. They usually would give 5 or 6 lectures in a week and then offer people the opportunity to participate in still point breathing, and then they'd move on, and there'd be no support for the support group if they wanted to start or for people who wanted to learn about it. And so they jumped at the chance back in 2001 at the beginning of that year. Let's see, not 2001, 2011. And they started the MindShifters radio show, which is what you're listening to now. And for the first 8 years, it went 1 hour a day, 5 days a week. And for the last more than 2.5 years now, pushing 3 years now, we've had 2 hours a day, 5 days a week, since I felt called to help expand the exposure to this work. So that's available in the archive, the website at mindshiftersacademy.org is available. And one last call, if you're interested, there's a support group tonight on Zoom. And or you can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org and submit your comments, your questions, or your suggestions for someone that we might interview, either for the Journey's Dream On Your Mind podcast or the very show you're listening to now, the Mind Shifters Radio. So without further ado, here's Dr. Michael Rice doing the first hour of Empowered to Heal. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false.
Tonight in our topic, Empowered to Heal, we want to look at the question, what is health, and what is the cause of health? If you look at the traditional approach in the world, what you'll find is that in order to find health, our billions of dollars are usually spent researching disease. And we're going to look at the idea that that just might be a backward approach, and that maybe health is about something else than an absence of disease. And what is its definition? What is health, really? And the best definition I've been able to come up with for health is not that health is an absence of symptoms or pain, but that rather health is living in our natural condition, living as the being that we are. Now, if you look at the most ancient teachings, the most ancient teachings tell us that we're made of the stuff called love. And the best definition I've found for health is that health is a state of conscious, active, present love in the human organism. And when we don't have that, we're in a dis-ease state. Disease is not something out there that invades us from the outside and takes us over. Break the word down, it's dis-ease, a lack of ease. And when as human beings, we don't have the condition of love in our minds, in our emotions, and in our physiology, we are literally in a dis-ease state. And that creates a disturbed physiology that leads to what we call organic disease. Now, if you look into most of the schools of healing, they've recognized the thing that they call a second-year syndrome. And the second-year syndrome is what happens in schools of psychology and different schools of healing, where the people studying diseases develop the diseases they're studying. A statistically significant number of specialists die of their specialty. Heart specialists die of heart disease. Cancer specialists die of cancer. Why? Well, in the workshops that we've done in the previous evenings, we've posited the theory that you and I, we are creative beings. If we are creative beings, how is it that we create? Well, science doesn't particularly talk about that, but if you go back to the ancient Aramaic language, in the opening words in the book of John, where we're told it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh, it doesn't say that in Aramaic. What it says in the ancient Aramaic is that in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. We were told how it was that we create what happens in our lives. And if we have an intense focus on the vibration, on the energy of disease, what is it that becomes organized? What is it that falls into place in our organic structure? And I'd offer that with an intense focus on disease, we tend to develop diseases. Now, if you look at those who would purvey the things that suppress the symptoms of disease, you'll notice that wherever they're advertised, generally speaking, the first thing that's done is an intense emotional focus on the disease process. Why is that? Does somebody know what they're doing? I mean, think about it. You see the child suffering and the worried parent, and you're drawn into that picture. With what? An intense focus on the disease process, and then pops in the solution. Well, we're going to take a different perspective than that, and we're going to look at how it is that we as human beings create, and how we move into the state where we are empowered to heal. That each of us carries with us an energy and a capacity. And that energy and that capacity can make of us disease producers or producers of healing. And it depends how we take charge of our own mind energy system. Again, look at those words. In the beginning was the mind energy. And the mind energy became flesh. Now, if you listen to Einstein, we've quoted this several times, but let's do it again. Einstein says this, on such things as matter, we have been all wrong. Okay? Where does matter fit here? It fits on this side of the equation. On such things as matter, says Einstein, we have been all wrong. What we have heretofore called matter is energy. Energy whose vibrations have become so lowered as to be perceptible to the senses. There is no matter. Einstein's telling us matter doesn't exist. And you'd almost think he was reading from the book of John, wouldn't you? In Aramaic. Now, he didn't put the factor of mind in there, but if you look at what organizes, what becomes organized is the mind energy that we engage in. It's our creative capacity. And you look back into the most ancient and the Old Testament teachings, and you hear the Creator saying to human beings, of the works of my hands command ye me. What would we call everything on the right side of this equation? Would we say these are the works of the hands of the Creator? Then what is it that sets things in motion from the left side of the equation? Well, according to that statement, it says, your command is what tells the Creator what to do. Oh, Michael, that's blasphemy. Well, blasphemy or not, hey, I'm just reporting the news. Go read the book. That's what it says. Of the works of my hands, command ye me. The Creator's saying, tell me what you want, folks. I'm on the inside. I'm making the whole system work. But I'm going to make the system work according to the way you want it to work. Now, if you want to take the time to study how the system works, you'll figure out that you're the one who's telling me what to do. And if you don't want to take the time to figure out how the system works, then you'll think that you're a victim of something out there, some bug that caused the disease. And there are no bugs that cause diseases. There are no bacteria, there are no viruses that cause diseases. Yes, they are a corollary of disease. They're there when the disease process happens. But that's because the decay of tissue gives rise to a cleanup crew. It is not because the cleanup crew causes the disease process. Now, we have this energy system. When you start to look at and why is it sometimes a difficult process to arrive at this place of healing, to arrive at this place of understanding, to arrive at the place where we are empowered to heal in every area of our lives. Well, if you look at this human system, what has been organized, if it's true that what has been organized is mind energy, there's a pretty massive accumulation there. In order to show up as this complex a system, it's a pretty massive setup. And when you look at the amount of mind energy that's been put into the system that doesn't belong in the system, and how habituated it is, how habitual it's become to stay focused in the disintegrative mind energy patterns. Now, if you go to the Aramaic language in the Lord's Prayer where it says, forgive us our debts, that word debts can be properly translated habits. get us out of our habit mind. You see, one of the keys to healing is you've got to be out of your mind. That's one of the keys to the process. That you've got to be out of the state where you're stuck in the past. Because the mind energy of the past doesn't leave us available to the present moment. And if we're not available to the present moment, it's difficult to engage in the condition of love that is available continuously for each of us. Now, if you go back again to the ancient teachings, they tell us that we have two different bodies. We have a physical body and a spiritual body. Now, when you look at that, you start to recognize that everything that's in the so-called physical body, or what was called the temple, is an energy that's come from the mind energy of the past. By the fact that it's solidified into form, it is already in the system. And this so-called physical, its name was Adam. Adamos means red clay. So we have this system that's made of red clay, and the red clay stores memory. And then what it has stored as memory, when it makes a reappearance in our minds pretend, or so it would seem, that what's coming from our past is actually the present. And if we as creative beings get locked in that past and keep producing it over and over and over again, then we'll be stuck in that syndrome of, why is this happening to me again? Now, when I say everything from the human mind, from the Adam mind, and you'll remember the ancient teachings talked about the fact that we have two minds, that we have the ability to be in Adam's mind, or be what was called being a son of Adam, or we have the ability to be in the Creator's mind. You'll remember Paul said the goal of the work was to be of like mind with Christ. In other words, to engage another mind. If we continuously engage the mind of the past, then we're going to keep reproducing in our creative process the past. And you've got to start to deal with present time, bypassing what's gone in the past, if you're actually going to heal what's in your system from the past. Now that may seem like, gee, Michael, I've always been taught to experience life through my mind. How else can you do it? Well, that's one of the problems. That's what we've always been taught. And one of the keys is to be able to step back from your mind and observe it in operation. To kind of become the thinker apart from the thought, the feeler apart from your own feelings. So I'm going to invite you for a moment to do that, if you would. I'm going to ask you to step back from your mind for a moment. And as you do, just watch what happens in your mind. Observe it and catch it at its game. How about, if you would, putting your right hand on your right ear? Would everybody do that? Put your right hand on your right ear? Now, you'll notice if you look around the room that everybody's doing pretty much the same thing. All right, put your hands down. Now, why did everybody do the same thing? Well, obviously, Michael, you told us to. I've got a different theory. I don't think that's why you did what you just did. I think that you, like I, had a mother who taught you, this is a hand, this is an ear. And when I spoke those words, I resonated a reality from your past, stored in your Adam mind. And when I resonated that reality, it came forward and gave you a set of instructions, and you followed those instructions. Let's imagine, for example's sake, that Jerry has a different past than everybody else in the room. Let's imagine that Jerry's mother taught him this is an ear instead of this. When I said put your right hand on your right ear, what did Jerry do? Did he do this like everybody else? No, he did this. Why did he do something different? I mean, we're all in the same room at the same time. I gave the same instructions to everybody. Why did he do one thing and you do another? Because the instructions that came from his mind, from his past, resonated by my words in the present, were different from the instructions that came from your mind in your past. So did you actually follow my instructions? Or did you follow the instructions that were in your Adam mind, that came from your past. Two totally different behaviors based upon what was in past. Now, it can be difficult to catch the mind at its game at first, at its trap. And so building a time delay in can help to make it easier to catch the mind at its game. So I'm going to ask you once again to step back from your mind and observe it in operation. And as you step back and observe it in operation, this time instead of putting your right hand on your right ear, would everyone please put your right hand on your gizzard? Would everybody do that? Put your right hand on your gizzard? Now, notice what just happened in your mind. And unless I miss my guess, it probably went something like this. Gizzards, let's see. Chickens have a gizzard and they're up here, or they're down here, and do I have one or just chickens? Kind of how it went. Notice you went searching through your past to find a reality for the present. Now, if in every experience of your life, you have to look through your past to find a reality for the present, where do you live? You live in the past. Those who lived in the past were said to be the dead, who were buried by the dead. If we don't know how to step out of our past, if we don't know how to step out of Adam's mind and bypass what has already gone before us, we cannot be open to fresh creation. And as creative beings, that's what our capacity is, to engage in original creation. And when we engage in original creation, we must, of necessity, engage in it out of our created being, which is love. Now, there's a big argument going on the planet, creation versus evolution. And that's a really important argument if you think you're a body. Because, of course, whether your body came from apes or not might be important. But when you realize that you are not a body, it's an irrelevant discussion. There is a created essence called a soul in Aramaic, nafsha. And then there's a physiological component, or what was called the Adam body. If you go back and you read the creation story, and I want to really make it clear that when I approach this whole process from the Aramaic, I'm not looking to delve into religious principles. I'm looking to the Aramaic, which is a physics language, the Aramaic, which is the native language not only of Jesus, but of five of the world's major religions. There's a reason for that. And I think the reason is because each of those religions started out of a physics language that knew how the world worked. And then usually men took over and made it how men wanted it to work and used it to control others. But in the original essence, there was a story about, here's how life works, folks. So let's look at the creation story. You'll notice in Genesis, the Western creation story, there are two stories about the creating of human beings. You ever looked at that? The first one says, in the image and likeness of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. Period. End of story. The human being is created. Now, I've heard some preachers stretch a long way to make sense of this because just a couple of lines later it says, there was no man to till the soil. And they start another creation story. It's like, was Moses getting senile here or what? No, I don't think so. I think that it was known exactly what was being said. There was no man to till the soil was saying there was no physiological component. There had not yet been the solidification that we call matter. The creation of the human being had occurred. We are created essence love, a spirit being made in the image and likeness of a spirit being called God, a spirit being called love. If you go forward to John, it says that the Creator, God, is love. And we're made in the image and likeness of that. So here is our essence created of love. Now, I've asked this question of you before, and I'll ask it again, because it's such an important question. How many can remember coming into a world and looking around at the world of strife and conflict and fight and negativity, and looking through small eyes that said, that's not the way the world's supposed to work. It's supposed to be different than that. How many remember knowing? most everybody remembers. And because we're doing this on camera, I won't go to the audience, but every time I ask this question, the same reply comes. It's some variation on the theme of love. Why? Because you and I are made of the stuff called love. We come into this life knowing what we're made of, knowing what we're here to express, and then the world goes about tearing us out of it, and we tend to buy in. So let's look at the second creation story, the soul. Love is created. And then the second aspect says, there was no man to till the soil, no physiological component. And then it goes about developing the evolution story. And then Adam is now present. And then the final statement marries the two. Adam is created, and the final statement there says what? And God breathed into Adamos nafsha. So the created spiritual essence, love, is now breathed into this evolved physiological system. God breathed nafsha into Adamos, and nafsha became a living or an incarnated being. Now, imagine this physiological system that's evolved through this strife-filled world, through this conflict world, and it has lots of protect mechanism and knows all about survival. Survival is its game. And imagine this soul being breathed in and saying, "Hi, I'm your new landlord." And Adam saying, Adamos saying, "Well, what are you talking about? What do you mean?" "Well, the Creator breathed me in here and said I'm in charge now. You see, you're just a set of programs. You run on a pre-programmed survival mechanism. And now I've got choice. I've got something new in the creation. Something showing up now that's never been before." And you'll notice if you look through all of the creation, you don't find one creature that goes against what it's programmed or structured to do. You know, you won't find two robins in the spring that come back to Omaha and land in your backyard, look at each other and say, "Isn't it great to be back in this beautiful backyard? But dear, you know, we've been coming here for 5 years, and every year we build a robin's nest. I think this year we should build an Oriole model." You won't find a robin doing that. The robin can't do elsewise but to build a robin's nest. You won't find a salmon in the South Pacific swimming along in those nice warm waters that all of a sudden gets the call and says, say what? You want me to do what? Let me get this clear. You want me to leave these nice warm South Pacific waters? You want me to swim 3,000 miles back to that icy cold stream that I was spawned in? You want me to swim upstream, get half beat to death on the rocks, lay eggs and die? You're crazy. I'm not going. You won't find a salmon that does that. The salmon gets the call. It finds the very pool in which it was spawned and does exactly what it's structured for. And so it is with Adamos, the physiology. It was an interesting piece of research that was done by a psychologist and several years ago. And actually, I don't know whether the research is as interesting as the fact that he got something like $9 million from the government to do this research, if I remember the numbers correctly, and I may be off there, but a significant sum of money. And he wanted to research a thing called a sand flea. And what they had observed with these sand fleas, okay, a sand flea is a creature that digs a hole in the sand. And the interesting thing about it is that whenever it wants to eat, the sand flea goes and finds food, brings it back, sits it at the edge of its hole, goes back in the hole and does whatever sand fleas do when they do that. It comes back out, gets the food, and eats. Well, the psychologist decided that when the sand flea went back inside of its hole to do whatever it does, he'd remove the food. And so he did. And the sand flea comes out, and there's no food there. So it goes off, and it gets more food. And it comes back, sets it at the edge of its hole, goes inside, does whatever they do. The researcher took the food. The sand flea came back out, the food was gone. The sand flea goes and gets more food, comes back, sets it at the edge of its hole, goes inside. The researcher removed the food. The sand flea comes back out. You get the story? You know how long the sand flea went and did that routine? Until it starved to death. It doesn't. This physiological system doesn't have the capacity to change its own mind. Adam can't change. Can't change itself. Now, there are countries in which monkey meat in the past has been a delicacy. And the way they would trap monkeys is they'd take a coconut, they'd cut a small hole in the coconut, just big enough for a monkey to squeeze its hand in. They'd empty out the coconut meat, they'd put food in it that would attract the monkey and attach it to a tree. The monkey would come along, be attracted to food, stick its hand inside, get a handful of food, and now it can't get its hand out. And it's trapped. And it isn't bright enough to let go. The monkey body, monkey mind, the Adam mind, can't let go. It can just run whatever's in it over and over and over and over again. And so look at this creation story and see that our Adamo system has a memory bank filled with everything from its past. And it's programmed for survival. It knows how to survive. So let's imagine the objection that this Adam mind puts up to Naksha in saying, look, what do you know about life? What do you know about survival? I know how to keep us alive. Before I turn this system over to you, just because you've got choice, so what? Before I turn it over to you, I'm going to give you a test. There are two berry bushes over there. If we eat the berries off of one of those bushes, it will kill us. If we eat the berries off the other one, it'll nourish us. Do you know which berries to eat? What do you mean, kill us? What are you talking about, says Naksha. Doesn't know anything about death. And the ego mind, or Adam mind, explains death. Oh, gee, I didn't know anything about that. Well, I'll tell you what, maybe when it comes to choosing food, you better take care of it, because I don't know. Well, let me give you another test. There's a huge Tyrannosaurus rex down the road there. If we get upwind from it, and it gets a whiff of us, do you know how to escape? Escape? Why would I want to escape? What do you mean? Well, hey, we're in big trouble. If he catches up with us, we're dead. Oh, gee, I don't have a clue. I don't know. Oh, so you really don't know much about survival, do you? Well, I guess I don't know. Well, then maybe you shouldn't be in charge of this system. Maybe you're right. Tell you what, how about if we're in a survival situation, you run the show, Adam, and when we're not, my choice, I'll run the show. And so you can almost imagine this negotiated settlement. Now, how does this relate to you and I? Well, let's look at how it works in our lives. A situation that I think all of you will probably be able to identify with. Let's imagine that, and I'm going to assume, seeing as how you're watching this tape and you're at this workshop, that at some point in your life you decided that life was about love, that you wanted to go back to that original created condition and express life that way. And you'll notice that, especially in your closest relationships, you were fully able to do that, right? Until that person you're in relationship with gave you the look. And what happened to your choice? How do they determine what's a survival situation? Well, we could easily imagine that this negotiation that took place between Naksha and Adam resulted in, well, let's invent an emotional meter. And the meter goes from 1 to 10. Anything above a 7 is survival. As long as the meter's below 7, you've got choice. It's up to you. Do whatever you want. But if something comes along that resonates that emotional meter and it goes beyond 7, choice is over and you're going right back to the old programs. You're going to run life just the way your past has structured you to run life. And if hate and fear and intimidation and gossip and slander and vengeance have been what's in your past, your monkey body, your monkey mind can't let go. It doesn't know how to change itself. But you, Naksha, when you wake up, remember the creation story? One of the first things that happens to Adam after the creation, it says, he fell into a deep sleep. You notice there's nowhere that it mentions him waking up? Why? Is it because most of us as created spiritual being, as love, have fallen asleep in that reality structure that comes from our atom bodies, and that whatever seeming decisions it makes, and its decisions are just repeated programs. They just run. In any circumstance that looks like a past circumstance, the program runs. Whether it's appropriate or not. Gee, I want to create love and support and nurturing my relationship, but if somebody gives me the look, well, gee, when I was 3 years old, that meant this 280-pound Hulk was going to come down and beat me with the belt. So now here I am, 40 years later, in a relationship with someone I love dearly, and they turn their head just the right way to resonate that old reality. What happens? Choice is gone. This is survival. And though now I'm dealing with the person that I love and not a 280-pound Hulk with a belt in his hand, what do I do? If I haven't forgiven, if I haven't removed that energy from my past, I'm going to play it out. And after I play it out, I'm going to say, oh, God, why did I do that? That's not what I wanted to do. That's not my choice. Anybody ever done that? Done anything against your own will and choice? Do you see why it happens? It's because when the emotion meter hits 7, you don't have choice. You're going to run on automatic pilot. But where your choice lies in the healing process, and each of the tools, people will say to me oftentimes, well, Michael, how do I heal this situation? How do I heal this? How do I heal that? All of the above. That's all we ever talk about. Every tool we teach in this work is about how you remove the realities from the mind that don't belong there so that this emotional meter doesn't hit 7. And you don't fall into survival where there's no survival issue involved. And so to wake up to who we really are and to take charge of this system and make real choices and remove from it that which does not belong in it is one of the keys to being empowered to heal. It's one of the ways that we wake up to who we are. So health, I would offer, is a state where we embody in our minds conscious, active, present love continuously. And when there is something less than love, we remove it. We take it out of the system. And we step back into who we really are as created spiritual essence, as love. And when we're able to presence love in our minds, whatever of those old realities that come forward that no longer serve us, those survival realities, by the simple exposure to love, by the capacity to hold love, conscious, active, and present, when one of those old emotional meter issues comes forward, it literally creates a transmutation of energy. Which tomorrow, if we face the same circumstance that today locked us into an old behavior we'd rather not do, by having exposed that old behavior to love, it changes. It diffuses the energy. It's called the process of forgiveness. Forgiveness in the ancient Aramaic language means a tool for changing a reality in your mind. So if there is a reaction, you know, break that word down, react. How did you react to that situation? In other words, how did you do an act that you'd been taught to do on a previous occasion? And that's all the atom mind's capable of, but as spiritual beings, we're capable of more than that. We are actors. And we are capable of engaging in original creation, of bringing into every circumstance in our lives the being that we are, the love that we are. And the ancient Aramaic is, for me, has been the closest that I've been able to find to describing that process and what it's about. And once you start to study the framework and the culture of the Aramaic in its true original form, and you will find things from the Aramaic that even those things are not on target when it comes to the teachings of Jesus. Why? Well, go back and you hear Jesus saying, even to the people of the day in Aramaic, you know, there are many things I would like to say to you, but you can't hear them yet. We've got to be able to deepen our experience to match the experience that was being talked about in that language to be able to comprehend it. Elsewise, a higher teaching has to be reduced in its level of understanding to the level that the person interpreting the teaching has reached. You can't be at a level 7 and understand a teaching at level 10. It just doesn't happen. And so to deepen your own process, to take charge of your own energy system and deepen the experience of being love, as you look at that teaching in Aramaic, you'll come more and more to comprehend what it spoke of in real human terms. And it loses its religious significance, and it takes on, for me, something much greater. It takes on the significance of life process. It wasn't about some intellectual process or ceremony called religion. It was about, here's how life works, folks. The Aramaic language was spoken for right from the Middle East to the Great Wall of China for 1,000 years before the birth of the man named Jesus and 1,000 years afterward. It was the languages of each and every one of the Old Testament prophets. It was the language of Baha'u'llah. It was the language of Zoroaster. It was the language of the Old Testament scholars. 5 of the world's major religions. Why did they stay around? Because of their level of understanding. Why is it that we want to go back to that language and that culture to gather an understanding? Well, let's use an example. Let's imagine that we go to the jungles of South America and we follow a fellow who has done a 5-day trek and he's 20 miles from his home. He's farther from his home than he's ever been. And he lives a jungle existence within his culture. He has never been out of those huge jungles in South America, and he's never experienced anything like modern civilization. And let's imagine being 20 miles from home, all of a sudden he hears this roaring noise. And he goes to the edge of the jungle to inspect. And he sees this huge yellow animal with round legs running back and forth in the jungle, just knocking down trees left, right, and center. And then he watches another huge animal come along and lay down this black surface over everything where the trees have been knocked down. And I mean, over a period of days and weeks, he just watches from the edge of the jungle in amazement as this happens. And then all of a sudden, one day, he hears this roaring noise in the sky. And he looks up and he sees this huge bird, bigger than any bird he ever could have imagined. And imagine this bird lands, and it's an unusual bird in that it opens its mouth, which is on the side instead of the front, like every other bird he's ever seen, and it spits out live people. I mean, this is some kind of bird, eh? And then it eats more people and takes off again with a roar. Now, of course, you and I know what he's just observed, don't we? But let's imagine now that our friend, having observed an airplane, goes back 20 miles in the jungle to explain to the rest of the tribe what he's just seen. Can he speak one true word about what he's observed? I mean, let's think about it. He saw this huge bird that was shiny like the sun. It had no feathers. Its skin was as hard as rocks. Its eyes were huge. Its mouth was on the... Can he say anything true about what he's observed? Not possible, is it? What is he going to have to do to enable him to speak to those 20 miles deep in the jungle about what he's experienced with an airplane? Well, he's going to have to come into and build the brain cells for what an airplane is and what modern transportation is. In the ancient Aramaic, that was called having the eyes to see and the ears to hear. So he's going to have to develop the eyes to see and the ears to hear what that's about. So let's imagine that he stays with these people, they meet him, they befriend him, they teach him the language, and now he understands about international travel. Can he go back into the jungle and explain to his friends 20 miles deep in the jungle what he's experienced? Can he say one true word about what he's experienced? No. They don't have, they've never been out of the jungle. International travel, what are you talking about? Airplane? Well, what are they going to have to do? They're going to have to build the brain cells. They're going to have the eyes to see and the ears to hear what's being spoken of. And so the first step is that they're going to have to develop the brain cells. Remember Jesus said his teachings were only for those who had the eyes to see and the ears to hear? Now there are things that you can say in the Aramaic language and culture that you cannot say in the westernized versions of those scriptures, because most of the westernized versions come from Greek. I've actually had preachers. I remember one man who had been a fundamental preacher for a little better than a half a century. And when I started to talk to him about the Aramaic, he literally, and I quote, said to me, "I don't care what Jesus said." I was just aghast. I couldn't believe what I heard. And his explanation was, "I studied the Greek and I know all about the Greek text. And that's enough for me." Well, that would be like our jungle friend going back into the jungle knowing nothing about the language of international travel and explaining to his friends what he just experienced and trying to make a logical sense of it. You ever looked at a lot of the scriptures and it's like, how does this make sense? Where is this coming from? Well, that's why. Because there are things you can't say in Greek that are said in Aramaic. Why? Well, if you look at the whole Greek, and let's look at the difference in the philosophy and the understanding of the Western mind that produces an airplane and international travel, and the jungle inhabitant who hasn't been outside of the jungle or a 20-mile radius. There are no words, there are no concepts that can be communicated effectively between those two worlds until the brain cells are built to make sense of it. Well, in precisely the same fashion, if you can see the dichotomy there, let's look at the ancient Aramaic, where you have a man named Jesus who says things like, "The Father within me does the work. It is the Father's good pleasure to bring you the kingdom. And if you ask, you will receive." Now, let's just take that part of it. And then let's see if you can say those things in a Greek conceptual framework that knows nothing of internalized God, but rather has this whole external pantheon. These creatures that kill their mothers, rape their daughters, do all sorts of horrid things. They're called gods in that Greek philosophy, right? In the Greek mythology. And the powers are all externalized. Now Jesus talks about a process of forgiveness, which is a way that you reach into your own mind to remove the realities from your mind that are your disease. And then you go to the Greek language, which has externalized all the powers, and instead of forgiving, you start pardoning. Instead of a power within, it becomes some horrified power out there that's out to get us. Look at the whole base of understanding, and now look at the Western mind and how many are still looking for some God out there that's going to get them and some afterlife out there. And the name of a man who in Aramaic said, "Hey, if somebody tells you the kingdom of God's over there, over there, over," don't believe them. It's within you. You can't make sense of it in Greek. It's not until you go back to that Aramaic structure that the whole energy system starts to make sense. For me, when I first contacted the Aramaic, it was so exciting to me because my background was in electronics and physics. And what I immediately saw was, this is a physics language. This language describes how life works. This language describes how this physiological system works. Ah, mind energy organizes this world of flesh. This makes sense. And all of a sudden, when you go to that framework, the whole thing starts to fall into place. And it is built to liberate people. You go back and listen to Jesus, and he says, "Know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Now let's look at what is generally referred to in our culture as the beloved King James Version of the Bible. You know, if you went back and talked to the Founding Fathers, the Founding Fathers would not touch that book. because it was government issue. It came from the king. The previous versions of the Bible did not support the divine right of kings. James said, I want the divine right of kings in there. And he went about having a translation done. Now, let's look at the structure in England at the time when James had that book written. The way the culture was organized was sort of on a pyramid level. You know, pyramid schemes in our culture are illegal, right? Why? Because it turns over everything from the bottom levels to those at the top, and the people in the bottom end up losers. So you look at that structure, and you had a group of people who were literally chattels. They were owned by the property owners. The whole base of the pyramid in that culture were people who, if the overlord sold his lands, everybody breathing, by the way? If the overlord sold his land, the people went with it. They were owned. They were property. Now, you don't have to look very deeply to see, you know, you just look at the word that was used to describe them. What were they called? Peons, right? And what happened? They produced on the land, they worked the land, they sometimes were able to keep enough to eat, and they turned over the results of their produce to the next layer, to the overlords, to those above them, who of course were fewer in number, but they basically owned the property and owned the people that worked the property. And of course, that next layer, that next level, had to turn over what they produced, a certain percentage. They got enough to keep them alive, a little more than the peons. And they went to the next level. And it went up to the next level. And who sat at the top? The king. Now, how many are naive enough to believe that this guy wants to accurately represent the teachings of a man who said, know the truth and the truth will set you free? Not very likely. And so when we start to go back into the actual original teachings of Jesus in his native Aramaic, in his native tongue, we'll start to see that he was about liberating people and teaching them of their creatorship. And that what he was teaching them was how to remove the dis-ease processes that they had engaged in. He taught them how to forgive every reality that was not in their minds. And so healing is not about fixing a broken part of the system. If we put into this system an energy, look at this thing as an energy system, and we put into it an energy that does not belong in it, wherever we store that energy, we set up a dis-ease process. The process of healing is not the process of suppressing the symptoms that reflect in the organized state, in the organic structure, but rather the process of healing results from removing what does not belong in this system. Removing the overlays that we've put in it that block its original intelligence, its original capability, and its natural state of health. So if we're ready to look at the problem, we get to see what's really going on. Now I'd like to move from the ancient physics language of Aramaic into some modern writing, and I'm going to read some work from a man named Fred Alan Wolfe. Fred Alan Wolfe is a physicist. He's a former professor of physics at the University of Paris and at San Diego State. And here's what he says. He says, the only mystery, let's look at the world from and look at physiology now from a physicist's point of view. The only mystery of quantum physics lies in the wave-particle duality described by Richard Feynman, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. He says that atomic objects, electrons, protons, neutrons, etc., sometimes behave like particles and at other times behave like waves. In other words, what do we have? We have a state where this thing we call matter is spread out over space as a wave, or it collapses and becomes a particle. So he says, atomic objects, electrons, protons, neutrons, etc., sometimes behave like particles and at other times like waves. When does an atomic object behave like a particle and when like a wave? According to many quantum physicists, the answer depends on whether or not the object is observed. Key, what is observation? The action of simple observation causes the wave to collapse, producing a particle. Nobel laureates Eugene Wigner, Brian Josephson, and many other physicists believe that this action of consciousness is a fundamental event beyond physics. Fred Alan Wolf goes on to say, we view it as the action of consciousness. Without such actions, the world and all of its participants would remain wispy, ghost-like quantum waves, and there would be nothing physical at all. Now, what is this thing we call the observer? Well, when you recognize we live in an energy universe, let's do something here with color that'll kind of demonstrate what we're talking about. Let's imagine that we have a blue potential. Let's imagine that we have a wave that is a red potential. We have a green potential. We have a purple potential. Now, let's imagine that each of these are potentials for solidifying or collapsing and becoming the world of matter. But something has to interact. Something has to add an energy to any one of these for it to collapse and become a particle. So let's imagine now that we have an observer whose mind energy, let's let this blue represent a world of fear. Let's let red represent a world of anger. Let's let green represent a world of healing. And let's let purple represent a world of love and awakened spirituality. If we have a person whose mind energy has been filled with this frequency, brain cells have been filled to the max with fear and intimidation. And you'll recall the last few nights I've talked about the work I did several years ago with Marcel Vogel, who was a 23-year senior scientist from IBM. Marcel developed the instrumentation in the lab with which to measure the high energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought. So when we put the realities of fear into a mind, we set there an energy. All energy is in motion, and all motion produces an energy wave. So if that's the frequency, if that's the wave that this person, and if you could trap the whole world of people into those brain cells of fear, out of the quantum potential, which wave is going to be in resonance, which through resonance is going to have energy added to it and is going to collapse? We're going to see this collapse out of the quantum soup or the quantum potential and become the world of matter. Now, once it has collapsed, imagine you're the observer looking at all these fearful people out here. Do you suppose it's going to do any good to work on trying to get them to change? It's not going to happen. You're going to have to go back to where it started. Remember Job in the Old Testament said, that which I feared most has come upon me. What was he saying? He was saying, oh, I see, I'm a creator. When I engaged in fear, I set up an energy wave. I set up a frequency. And here it is, come to visit. Now, instead of trying to get rid of the visitor, I think I should probably go back and forgive, which means what? I'm going to literally restructure the brain cells. What are we going to restructure them with? Well, if I forgive, and remember that forgiveness means a tool you apply to a reality in your mind to remove that reality, which is a tool that you apply to an energy in your physiology, which if it is fear, is a disease energy, and whatever tissue it's in, it violates the integrity of that tissue. So you remove that, you forgive that, and all of a sudden, this wave is no longer the predominant resonant energy in your mind. What's going to tend to happen? This wave that has collapsed will tend to go back to the world of potential, and its solidified nature will disappear. Now let's say that having dealt with the fear, oftentimes the next stage is to get really peeved about what they've done to us, to get really angry. So if the next predominant resonant energy is red, if that's what shows up, having forgiven the anger, all of a sudden now I'm really peeved at what's been going on all this time. This is an energy. This energy sets up a field. What now starts to become manifest in the potential world? You know, they spoke in the Aramaic of illusion. And usually in our culture, we're taught that illusion means something that doesn't exist. In the Aramaic, the root of the word illusion is not something that doesn't exist. The root of the word illusion is measured. Remember they said, as you measure, it will be measured unto you? As you put an energy into your mind, guess who's coming to dinner? Guess what's going to show up? You set up a frequency, and out of the quantum soup, out of the potential, what you have measured solidifies, collapses, and becomes your experience. Is anger ever going to get you where you want to go if you want to live a delightful life? If you want to heal, it's not going to happen. Now, you might have plenty of reasons to be angry. You might have plenty of reasons to be horribly abusive to them. But that's really not the essential question. If you want to heal, the essential question is, though they deserve it, do you? Because you get the original, they just get the carbon copy. And if they're not in resonance, they're not going to play. If you really want to heal, you have to take charge. And you go back and you listen to Jesus, and he said, you know, the first order of business, the first law of life, of aliveness, of joy, of creativity, of really high-level wellness, is you've got to hold the condition of love in your mind. And when you do that, you'll start to dismantle that energy, that information in brain cells that resonates and sets up lots of things to be angry about. And as you change that frequency from your mind, that potential, or pardon me, that which is solidified, will tend to go back to the world of potential and dissipate. And the next step is you'll start and you'll begin to engage in the healing process. And when that becomes the predominant resonant energy in your mind, you'll set up. And what you'll find is you'll create a world and you will start to attract people and circumstances that will support your healing process. All of a sudden, in the same world where yesterday you find all kinds of reasons to be angry or fearful, all of a sudden you'll look out and you'll literally see different evidence. You'll literally draw different people to you and you'll go, gee, you mean there's actually support in this world for healing? You mean I don't have to live in rage and fear? And you know, as people extract from that world of rage and fear, sometimes they're very, you know, they may be apart from 2, 3, 4, 5 years. They're very surprised when they go back to their old haunts and find that rage and fear is still there. I've had that happen many times. People go back and they go back to see dear old friends, and all of a sudden they find that, gee, there's no resonance left. Dear old friends are dear, but there's just no energy exchange. They're just not living in the same world.